So I guess I'm going to start with a brief presentation on the G8 in 18 minutes, everything you've ever wanted to know about the Group of Eight. So yeah, the Group of Eight, or the G8, is meeting in Kananaskis at the end of June. And the G8 is this sort of amorphous institution. It's not quite an institution. It doesn't have a permanent secretariat. It doesn't have any headquarters anywhere. It's basically a meeting of the eight heads of state of seven of the most industrialized countries in the world, and therefore the wealthiest countries in the world. So the G8 countries are the US, the UK, the Canada, the European, well, members of the European Union, so that includes Germany, Italy, and France, as well as Japan. And it also includes Russia, which isn't one of the most industrialized or the most wealthy nations in the world, but has been included, was included in 1998 for political reasons. Now, when you see the photo ops, and most of what the G8 summit will be a grand photo op, you'll notice 10 men. So obviously there's a counting issue here. The extra two guys are members of like high-ranking officials with the European Commission. So that's where they're at. When I said they're meeting in Kananaskis, I usually use the term they're retreating to Kananaskis. And they're retreating to Kananaskis, to a nice little secluded resort town in Alberta. But originally, they were supposed to be meeting in Ottawa. They were supposed to be meeting in Ottawa, but then Genoa happened. And I'm not sure who remembers Genoa. Okay, good. Genoa, that makes my task easy. Genoa happened last summer. The G8 met in Genoa, Italy, and hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets to protest some of the same policies that we'll be talking about tonight. And Silvio Berlusconi called in the military and called in the police, called in the carabinieri, and hundreds of people were beaten while sleeping in an organizing space, and a man named Carlo Giuliani was shot and killed. And after Genoa, Jean Chrétien decided that maybe Ottawa wasn't really the best place, was maybe a little bit too accessible a place for Canada to host the meetings at. So he's moved it to Kananaskis, which will be a militarized zone for the duration of the meetings. And it's taking place in this nice little resort where, according to one U of T academic who studies the G8, leaders can be leaders. And according to Jean Chrétien, it's a nice retreat-like environment where leaders can get to know each other on a personal basis. Next year, the G8's meeting in France. And population is a bit more dense in France than here, and there aren't really many places that they can put it that's like Kananaskis where protesters won't be able to get to. So we're trying to guess where they're going to try to put it. And my bet is on Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon, which is, the little colony off Newfoundland. So get your boats ready. The G8, when it started meeting in 1975, it met in Rambouillet, France. And these are sort of the boring things about the G8. It met originally as the Group of Six. Canada and Russia weren't involved. And it met in response to the OPEC oil embargo and the global recession that incurred in the change in currency policies. And it met primarily to coordinate economic policy. So its mission was basically about global economics. The most wealthy nations meeting together, Western nations, largely wealthy because of years of colonialism and sort of rape and pillage in southern countries. And they got to meet alone to discuss how the global economy was going to function. And then gradually, as years have worn on and people have started to sort of question what exactly their mandate to do something like that is, they've started talking about things in slightly broader terms. And one of the terms that you'll hear a lot around the G8 is a term called global governance. Their mandate is now to govern globally. Global governance tends to mean reconciling trade and non-trade agendas. So talking about trade, talking about economic growth, but acknowledging that, human rights violations go on and there's a severe amount of debt in African nations, and we have a duty to, as wealthy countries, help relieve that debt. So all those nice, liberal, fuzzy things that make sort of an expanding economy kind of palatable to those of us who are kind of concerned that maybe the G8 is a slightly elitist institution that's maybe perpetrating huge crimes all over the world, and maybe there's something messed up about this whole meeting. On this caravan, we've been talking a lot about global governance and the way it's selling the G8 this year to a very critical sort of North American audience in terms of the ABCs of the G8 or of global governance. And so the ABCs this year are Africa, Bono, and consultations and co-optation. I'm going to go through each one of those because it starts to give you a sense of what they will actually be discussing, or at least what they want us to think that they're discussing at these meetings. If we start with Africa, it will be sort of the centerpiece, the media focus of the whole summit. They'll be talking a lot about the new Partnership for Africa's Development, the NEPAD. And the NEPAD is a proposal put together primarily by Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, along with a Senegalese leader the president of Nigeria, the president of Algeria. And basically, the NEPAD, which I have right here, is a document that asks for a new partnership between the West and the G8 nations, who it acknowledges have been, you know, culpable of quite a bit of exploitation in Africa, and Africa itself. And there's a number of ways in which South African and other African activists are taking this document to task, and one of them is that it claims to be a cry of the African people, to be a collective process and the voice of Africa. But in fact, it hasn't been drafted in consultation or with any active participation of grassroots groups in Africa. It has basically evolved since 2000 under various names. One of them was, you know, the New African Initiative, the NAI. And it's basically involved in meetings at Genoa, at the World Economic Forum, in meetings with the EU. And so has been sort of a collaboration, in fact, between Thabo Mbeki and Western leaders. And when you look at it carefully, the strategies it wants to implement in order to create this new partnership for Africa's development are the exact same strategies that are in fact already in place. So you see sort of an acceptance of IMF and World Bank structural adjustment programs and the heavily indebted poor countries initiative, whereby the most indebted African countries have some of their debt forgiven in order to keep their debt sustainable. But what it also means is that Western countries and the IMF and the World Bank are allowed to impose the same sorts of conditionalities on African economies. So a mandate to expand trade, which means opening starting trade agreements between countries that have totally unequal power, so between, say, Morocco and the EU. It means attracting more foreign direct investment and strategizing to do that by privatizing more and more African social services. And in South Africa, for example, that has meant a push under Mbeki himself to privatize things like electricity and like water. And in the case of water, that means that poor families or poor neighborhoods in their entirety who aren't able to pay the hookup fee when a private company comes in to supply water are disconnected and are forced to use water from, you know, non-potable sources, and then you have a whole cycle of cholera epidemics, etc. And so just to sort of sum up the ways in which the strategies that NEPAD offers are basically sort of more of the colonial and specifically neo-colonial policies that the G8 nations have used in order to become the G8 nations that they are. An activist in South Africa named Trevor Ngawe talks about about how this sort of partnership can only be described as a partnership between rider and a horse. And I'm going to read a quote by Ngawe, talking about Nipad. He says, "The relationship between Africa and Western Europe has been one between colonizer and colonized, exploiter and exploited. While the exact terms of this predatory relationship have evolved over time, it seems foolhardy for Mbeki and company to ask for partnership with people who still benefit from Africa's wealth at the expense of the African people. Imperialism is the problem. A partnership with it cannot be a solution." So I think as the G8 discusses the Nipad and uses it to say, look, protesters, we are taking care of Africa. The African people have asked us for this, have asked us to endorse this plan. You go away, you're kind of privileged, you live in the north, you're rich, you're spoiled brats, actually, don't really know what you're talking about. I think we have to remember those words, remember the phoniness of any sort of partnership that could be developed out of this, and also recognize a friend of ours in Montreal who's studying the document has studied it and has come to the conclusion that in fact this document would require $64 billion from the G8 nations to actually implement all the sort of infrastructural development that it would require, and the G8 nations aren't actually going to be ready to pay that. So in fact, what they're planning to do is at the G8 summit, although they'll talk about the Nipad as the voice of Africa, they're going to endorse the Africa Action Plan. The Africa Action Plan, it is predicted, will entail much less aid to Africa, because as Yves Fall in Montreal put it, why would G8 nations pay more to have the right to exploit these nations for their oil, for their mineral resources, for a whole range of other natural resources, when they're already doing it and they can do it basically for free? And that's the sort of power imbalance that we're dealing with. On a side note, we just found out today that Trevor Ngawe, who I just read from, was arrested last Saturday with about 100 other activists in Soweto because they are waging this fight against privatization, not only of water, also of electricity. And so the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, of which he is the chair, went to the mayor's house for a demonstration, and they were shot at point blank by the mayor's bodyguard, and they were all arrested. 100 protesters were arrested. 60 have been released, but 40, including Ngawe, remain in prison and are being denied bail on the alleged premise that the police need to check their employment. But of course, many of them are actually established activists who have, they do have jobs. And so it's sort of a bit of a red herring. I think one other quote from one of a spokesperson for one of the organizations that were part of the protest sort of puts this struggle into context, but it also makes it sound very familiar here in Ontario, where we're also watching a Tory government begin the privatization of hydro, have watched a 21.6 cut to welfare take place, and a whole range of other privatization schemes. So he says, we must not lose sight of the fact that evictions, service cutoffs, and high service charges within an environment of spiraling unemployment have become a feature of the everyday lives of the protesters and many other communities across the country. It is regrettable that the demonstration took an ugly turn, but the union calls on the government to address the legitimate demands for basic services that poor communities are making. And I think he's making two points that I'll come back to, and I think the rest of the panel will come back to. The first being that people have a basic right to a whole range of services that should not be privatized. And when they are, it means that a whole wealthy elite strata of people are being enriched and being often protected by governments, by African governments, by the G8 states governments, at the expense of people who just need basic drinking water. And the other is that sometimes struggle is messy and really not very safe, and that that's worth it when you're fighting for water. To move on from Africa to Bono, which is the B in the ABCs of global governance, Bono has become the good friend of Jean Chrétien, of Paul Martin, Tony Blair, And at the G8 summit, Bono will be trotted out again, as he was at the World Economic Forum. And he will be used to sell debt relief. And I've already talked a little bit about the messed up nature of any sort of debt relief, right? If anything, we should be asking for reparations, or Africa should be asking and is asking, and through movements like the Jubilee South movement, should be asking for reparations, and asking for reparations from G8 nations, from wealthy Western nations who have committed crimes in the name of exploiting Africa and sort of siphon out resources without leaving anything behind. And Bono, you know, was interviewed in Time magazine right after the World Economic Forum, and in sort of this brief moment of insight, which I don't think has happened since maybe the Joshua Tree, he says, "I know how absurd it is to have a rock star talk about the World Health Organization or debt relief or HIV/AIDS in Africa. And it is absurd, and it's absurd precisely for the reasons I've already spoken about. It's absurd to think that any sort of partnership can be can take place between in a context of imperialism and of colonialism and context of neocolonialism. And it's also absurd to talk about debt relief when, if anything, we owe Africa far more than they could ever have to pay in debt." Finally, we have C, consultation. And consultation is another way in which the G8 is trying to sell itself as an open, democratic, sort of legitimate institution with a very legitimate process that takes into account all our concerns and all our needs. The Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade is sort of crisscrossing Canada right now, setting up consultations whereby NGOs and other people are invited to come give presentations about, you know, the sorts of things their community would like to see the G8 address. And that's lovely, but I think we'll find that if we went and started to talk, say, about reparations, or if we went and started demanding in our own communities an immediate stop to any privatization or, some policy that made it impossible for anybody to be homeless or to die on the streets of cold at night, I think we'd see that there probably wouldn't be much response. So consultation really only goes so far. However, in our case, consultation came to us. Because right before we left on this caravan, we were in Montreal, and I was checking my messages, and we get this call, and we get this message, and it's Lawrence Blanchford, who is the Deputy Director of G8 Summit Policy. And he just had heard that we were doing this anti-G8 caravan, and he wanted to make very sure that we had all the information we needed about the G8. So he was sort of coming to us, and, you know, he gave us his number, he asked us to call us. We've been really, really busy, so we haven't, but I'm going to give it to you, so if you have any questions after this, you can get in touch. So yeah, he's number 613-996-2471. That's an Ottawa area code. You can also go visit him on the days of the protests in Ottawa on June 26th and 27th. The other form of consultation that they're using widely in Canada in preparation for Kananaskis, and Team Alberta can talk about this more later if they want, but there's this G8 security RCMP division now, and they're consulting with activists. And, they just want to know, you know, what's being planned and how they can make the day successful for everybody. If you just tell us what you're doing, maybe we can tell you what we're going to do. Oh, gee, I wonder what that is. And we'll just all have a fine protest day in the nice, lovely trees of Kananaskis. Well, again, that's all lovely, but it's a process that's very much used to divide good protesters from bad protesters. The good protesters are those who will say what they're doing. You know, yeah, we're holding this G6B conference down miles and miles away from the summit site, and we don't really want to disrupt things, so we're good. And then the bad protesters just won't speak. And again, I think we need to look at this process of consultation as something extremely insidious, because I think we all know that when people are fighting for housing or for electricity or for basic food or for basic water needs, it's not a game. And it's not a board game that you can divide up and say, okay, well, I'm going to stay here and be good, and you're going to do whatever you do, and you know the meetings will go on, and G8 leaders will continue to perpetrate atrocities all over the globe in the name of economic expansion. It's not a game. It's messy, as you know, the quote I read before from the spokesperson in South Africa said, and that's something we need to think about seriously when we think about the validity of things like these consultation processes with G8 Summit Security. The G8's going to be talking about three themes, and I've already mentioned the first, which is Africa. They'll also be talking about economic growth, and again, I think I've already in some senses alluded to a lot of what they'll be talking about. The G8 has sort of 48% of the votes in the IMF. It has something like 45% of World Bank votes. So all these institutions are really quite closely related. And economic growth that takes place in an imperialist context is something that we need to always be critical of, and particularly in a year where Africa is going to be highlighted, I think we need to look at economic growth in sort of a context of a global apartheid, where wealth is systematically, again, siphoned from both from southern countries, but also from communities of color in North America and other places, in order to enrich a predominantly white strata of elite politicians and CEOs. All of these things will be talked about in order to sort of distract from the third item on their agenda, which is fighting the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, or so-called war on terrorism. And we already sort of know what that means on some level, right? It means, in Afghanistan, it means over 4,000 civilians who've been killed since September 11th, or since October 7th, when the bombing started. It has meant a tremendous refugee crisis that nations like Canada have done absolutely nothing to alleviate. Here at home, what it's meant for a lot of immigrant and refugee communities has been an intense crackdown and an attack. We've seen sort of anti-terror legislation pushed through, like Bill C-35, Bill C-36. We've also seen sort of a very quick implementation of anti-immigrant bills like C-11. That make it much harder to go through the process of seeking refuge here or gaining any sort of land and immigrant status. We've also witnessed, OCAP immigration people who we've talked to over the past couple of weeks can talk about the ways in which deportations have been speeded up. And that has often meant that people will be arrested in sort of police fishing expeditions where, you know, say they're looking for drugs in a neighborhood, usually a neighborhood where, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't white and who aren't middle class hanging around. They'll go in and sweep, and if people don't have proper ID, they're very rapidly arrested, detained, deported, without access to proper, to sort of even in what's mandated under the proper channels, so basic access to a lawyer, access to your family. And in some of the more horrific manifestations of this war on terror, we can look at Woomera in Australia, where people, mostly Afghani and Iraqi refugees, are being detained in a cage in a desert, and where people are themselves and telling their children to sew their lips shut and slash their wrists and drink shampoo, because the conditions under which they're forced to live as detainees and as refugees are so horrific that they can't take it anymore. And so themes like human rights and AIDS to Africa will be used to draw our attention away from this war on terror and what it means to people in really concrete and horrific ways across the globe. And it will also be used, I'm sure, by June, to draw our attention away from an impending war on Iraq. I think these are all reasons for which we have at least a duty to be enraged. if you can have a duty to be enraged. And there are all reasons for which I think it makes very much sense to be resisting the G8. And that resistance is part of a global resistance. And we can talk about global resistance. I think a lot of us here at this table understand, or at least try to understand, that, you know, this resistance didn't begin in Seattle, and it doesn't just stop at summits. In some ways, our inspiration for it is very much drawn from struggles in the South, for example, in Bolivia, where people fought in the streets for days and, you know, set up road blockades and were killed by militaries in order to fight against the privatization of their water source, and they kicked Bechtel, the corporation that was privatizing, out. Or we can look at Argentina, where after years of austerity, IMF and World Bank imposed austerity measures, people are rising up, have kicked three presidents out of office, and are now organizing in the streets, organizing on barricades, organizing road blockades. Unemployed workers are holding neighborhood assemblies and forcing politicians to come down and speak to them and negotiate with them on their terms. But I think we can also look at resistance that's taking place here at home. And I mean, there's Guelph-specific examples. When the Ontario Common Front and the Guelph Action Network organized an action here on November 5th to protest, you know, the 21.6 cut to welfare, the privatization of Ontario Hydro, the you know, the Safe Streets Act, that was resistance. We can also look at OCAP in Toronto, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, and in their casework on a day-to-day basis, they fight the most basic infringements of people's most basic rights. So, you know, demanding access to housing and making sure that people aren't evicted because they've been cut off welfare. And when, you know, so that's the sort of resistance we're looking at, and the sort of resistance that inspires us. And I'm going to let other people talk about how that resistance actually gets taken up and can ever be taken up in sort of high-profile summit meetings and summit protests. But these are all the sources of our inspiration, and I hope that they give us strength to kick the bastards out of Canada.